You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. What are we doing to the sea? Listen to this headline from Stockholm University. Human pressure on the world's ocean accelerated sharply at the start of the 21st century and shows no sign of slowing. Jean-Baptiste Jouffre is a PhD candidate at two respected Swedish institutions. He is the lead author of a massive analysis of the pace and the trends of human impacts on the ocean. The study was published in the journal One Earth. Jean-Baptiste Jouffre, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to connect with you. You're a young scientist who's done a team of people to a major new study. And we know that trawlers drag the sea bottom and wreck it, and miners and corporations, ocean farming. There's just so many ways we use and pollute the sea. What drove you and your team to add it all up, to search for that big picture?
Well, precisely what you just said, meaning recognizing the diversity of human use of the ocean. So there are some iconic use and historical ones when it comes to fisheries, for instance, or navigation and trade. The first globalization really happened when we started sailing to other countries and exchanging goods and commodities with other cultures, nations. But there is an increase of the diversity of uses of the ocean, and that's something that triggered our curiosity to try to understand what we were going into the ocean for.
Well, let's get to a few examples people may not think about. For example, you have a box which describes seabed grabbing. What are you talking about there?
That's an interesting one, because seabed grabbing is often associated, or at least land grabbing is associated with sometimes like illegal practices. In the case of seabed, there's nothing illegal. It comes from an Article 76 in the United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea that was signed in 1982, and it's considered the Convention of the Sea, right? So it's a set of articles that regulates what countries can or cannot do when it comes to the ocean. And one milestone of this convention was to establish what is known as the Exclusive Economic Zone. It's 200 nautical miles from the coastline, which is roughly 370 kilometers from the coastline of each country. And that area, that zone, grants exclusive rights to the given country to exploit, explore, manage, and conserve the resources of the water column and the seabed. So in an exclusive economic zone of a country, another country cannot come and fish, for instance, without an authorization or without trade agreement with the given country. And that applies to both the water column and the seabed, so the resources of the seabed and the subsoil. But Article 76 of this famous convention of the law of the sea grants that if a country is able to show, to provide geological evidence that the continental shelf of that country extend beyond the limits of 200 nautical miles, then the country can claim an extended continental shelf that would grant sovereign rights, again, for the exploration and exploitation of resources only of the seabed this time, not the water column, but the seabed beyond the limit of 200 nautical miles.
Well, I think that Canada was part of that process, because I can remember in the 1990s when the cod fishery collapsed off the Newfoundland coast, our east coast, that the Canadian government was trying to keep the Spanish and other countries from still coming and taking the last of the fish, and they sent out, I think, a destroyer or something. And we said, well, we're going to police the ocean far out from our shores, not just the 200-mile limit. And this is happening all over the world. You have published a map that shows that there's very little free ocean left after all the claims are taken into account.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the point of this. That's what we dubbed seabed grabbing, in the sense that many countries, it's a total of 83 different countries today since 2000, when the first claim was made by Russia concerning the seafloor below the Arctic. So a total of 83 different countries have actually claimed an extended continental shelf, and every of these claims is in effect shrinking what is considered the common heritage of humankind, which is the area beyond national jurisdiction. Now, what the map shows in the paper is both the exclusive economic zones and the extended continental shelf, which adds beyond those 200 nautical miles. And indeed, when you look at the map, you realize that if all the claims were to be granted, because a lot of them are either overlapping or conflicted or pending a decision from the UN body in charge of doing that, then only 48% of the actual seafloor remains shared inheritance of humankind.
And what did you find out about reclaiming new land for sprawling populations in places like China?
So that's a different claim, one of many ocean claims that we looked into and tried to document and quantify over time as well. And it's the one of land reclamation. And land reclamation is finally somehow an old claim. We've been doing that for a long time. And in the Netherlands, for instance, is quite an iconic example of land reclamation. It's pumping out the water from wetlands, for instance, to be able to establish infrastructure. And in recent years, interest has grown for that process in order to expand land into the ocean for airports, for residential area, for industrial area as well. And China, among many countries, in particular, is leading the world in large-scale reclamation projects by extending its coastline 100 square kilometers every year.
So in January 2020, a man named Will Hilton published a key article in The Atlantic magazine. The title is, "History's Largest Mining Operation is About to Begin. It is underwater, and the consequences are unimaginable." So who is regulating the rush to vacuum up the seabed for metals? What do you know about that?
Well, that depends. It's yet another ocean claim, which is the one concerning mineral and mining operation. And that the first distinction needs to be made is between mining operations within national jurisdiction and beyond national jurisdiction. So if the mining operation take place within your exclusive economic zones, so within the 200 nautical miles from your coastline, that's the country that is concerned, that is in charge of regulating the industry. Now, if it happens beyond national jurisdiction, in what is referred to as the area with a capital A, and again, which is the same area considered as the common heritage of humankind, then the International Seabed Authority, which is an autonomous body from the United Nations, is in charge of regulating that and ensuring some kind of benefit-sharing mechanisms for redistribution of the profits.
Okay, one other little detail from your paper that I just didn't know about. What are nutraceuticals?
Nutraceuticals, it's a combination of the word nutrition with pharmaceutical. And those are compounds and products that are thought to have health benefits beyond just nutrition. And it's a growing industry. It's a rapidly growing industry. Maybe one of the most illustrative example is the rush for omega-3 that you may see in your different stores when you go to groceries. And a lot of those omega-3 comes from the sea, either from what is called small pelagic, so small fish, or from the krill fishing in Antarctica. And it's a growing industry given the increasing interest in health and nutrition and healthy diets.
Your analysis investigated the growth of offshore oil and gas, water desalinization plants, shipping, cruise lines, and so much more. But some of the impacts on the ocean come from activities most of us would cheer, like offshore wind, conservation, or just gathering more science from the sea. Why count the solutions, too?
Well, that's a really good question. It's because the tone of the research is quite neutral in the sense that we did not focus on purpose only on industries, on extractive ocean industries, or only on impacts, or only on solution or conservation of the ocean. What we were really interested in trying to capture was all the hopes and the expectation that humanity has for the ocean. Like increasingly, we see the ocean as the new frontier for human development. And that doesn't mean only extractive industries. It also means a sustainable future. There is this narrative of the blue economy or the blue growth. And so the blue growth relates to a lot of the industries that are captured there. The blue economy is a concept that, depending on who you ask, you will get a different answer of what it means. And so what we focused on was the trajectory of those trends, meaning the blue acceleration. We were interested in showing that across all those hopes and expectations, they are rapidly and dramatically accelerating over the last 30 years. And that includes both extractive industries with severe impact on the environment, but also efforts to conserve and preserve the ocean, such as the establishment of marine protected areas, for instance, which is also exponentially increasing.
Looking through your paper, and maybe I missed this, but I didn't see acceleration graphs for things like increased underwater noise or plastics everywhere from the surface to the deep. I guess you could keep adding to this study for a very long time if you had the time.
Again, it's a really good point, but it links to the previous comment on how we did not focus specifically on impact, but rather use of the ocean. So a lot of the plastic that indeed finds its way into the ocean comes from land. And when it comes to noise or light pollution or even chemical pollution, this is some kind of indirect or sometimes direct effect of our uses of the ocean. But the data we gathered and collected was focusing on the direct use across different sectors rather than the impact of those sectors. But as you said, I think as many graphs as we have now, those trends could be mirrored by an increase in their impact as well.
And a lot of the graphs seem to show almost going straight up, not quite, but a very straight up motion starting around 1990 or so. Why did this acceleration happen? Do we know?
Well, that's very interesting. And the name itself, the Blue Acceleration, which shows that in spirit of what is often referred to as the Great Acceleration, which is work led by Will Stephan and colleagues, showing that after World War II, there was a rapid increase in both socioeconomic trends and their environmental impacts. Think about the world population that has, for instance, tripled since 1950, or the rate of deforestation, the loss of mangroves and coral cover across the globe. So all those trends have been referred to as the Great Acceleration, which is also one of the starting points that a lot of scientists point to when it comes to defining when did the Anthropocene start. The Anthropocene being the human age, like the time where humanity has become the dominant force of planetary change. And so in the spirit of this great acceleration, we looked at the blue acceleration, which shows the same trajectory, but with a time lag, as you pointed out, because it starts later. It doesn't start right after World War II. It starts rather at the onset of the 21st century, 1990-2000. And one can speculate of why that time lag, but there are two key mechanisms that may be at play. One of them is declining land-based resources, as simple as that. We're starting to run out of resources or space in some cases, and we talked about land reclamation, for instance, as a solution to solve land scarcity. And so as resources on land decline or become depleted, we're moving into the ocean to find them. And a good example of that is the offshore oil and gas industry. From between 2000 and 2010, 70% of the discoveries of new oil fields happened offshore rather than on land. Now, the second aspect, which is key, is technological progress. 50 years ago, it was unthinkable to lower down a submarine by 40,000 meters below the surface and start mining the seafloor. We couldn't even think about it. Same thing with marine genetic resources. We didn't have the tools nor the technology to explore the marine realm from the shoreline to the deep sea. And that is rapidly accelerating as well. And so as technology advances, we're able more and more to enter the ocean realm. So I think the combination of technological progress and declining land-based sources, coupled with growing population, meaning growing consumption patterns, and also we can talk about it later, maybe the effect of climate change, which is like opening up new space in the ocean. I think the collectively, those trends are explaining why we see this rapid increase over 30 years now.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is the young scientist Jean-Baptiste Chouffre from the Stockholm Resilience Center. He leads a new study showing the ocean is in danger, and they call it the Blue Acceleration. Your team worries about unknown consequences from this big tidal wave of change, and you speak about possibilities like large and abrupt transitions with persistent consequences. I guess we can't just add up each separate thing and think that we have the total, because these things, they combine and they interact with each other, don't they?
Yeah, I think that's one of the critical points of this work, in recognizing the diversity of ocean uses and ocean plains. Because when you see the trajectories, you realize that every sector in isolation is aiming at like a threefold, fivefold, tenfold increase over the last 5 years or 10 years. So there is this idea of infinite growth within each sector. And sure enough, the ocean is vast, but it's not limitless. And so if you start piling up all those trends and all those ocean claims, it's fairly intuitive to understand that it simply won't add up. And there, it won't add up from a resource perspective, but it also won't add up from an interaction perspective. And what I mean with that is that one can expect risk to emerge from the interaction between those claims on the ocean way before we actually run out of the actual resource that we're going for into the ocean. An example of that would be spatial conflicts. You cannot do deep sea fishing, like troll fishing, where you have fiber optic cables or pipelines. Or you cannot put an offshore oil platform where you have wind farms and so on. So spatially is the most intuitive to think of. But of course, each of those uses of the ocean having impacts, the impacts themselves might interact with each other and create the perfect storm. And that's a little bit what we're waving a red flag for. We don't know about that enough.
And we can't presume the future will be a straightforward continuation of the past. What are some of the emerging or almost sci-fi ideas that you encountered for using the sea in the future?
Yeah, and that again is critical. It's like, how can we anticipate like how the blue acceleration will unfold, right? It's really difficult. We know it's not a linear process. And experience has shown that predicting the future based on past trends is not successful very often. And so we need to find and reflect on ways to predict and forecast what might happen. There is a lot of work in ocean science that is being done when it comes to climate change or oceanic currents and forcings through modeling. So a lot of data-intensive exercises to model in the future based on different scenarios of temperature. It's used a lot when it comes to climate change, trying to model the impact of climate change on the ocean. And those are really necessary, and we need them, and they are extremely important. But they often miss the social component. They often miss the social in the social ecological system that the ocean is. And so we need different ways as well to incorporate the human component into those models. And so one method that has been used quite a lot when it comes to terrestrial system, a lot when it comes to agriculture and food production system, is what we refer to as participatory scenarios. And they are used to identify and analyze the role of existing but currently marginal drivers of change in shaping the futures. And so by doing that, it gives an opportunity to the participants to envision a positive future, and what they would see the ocean be in maybe 50 years or 100 years. And the interest of those exercises is to bring around the table a wide diversity of actors. It has little meaning to just bring industries, for instance, but But if you bring the private sector in several industries with the scientific community, with local communities as well, and sometimes native and indigenous communities, which are really reliant on the ocean, then it gives a really nice outcome where different worldviews and hopes and expectations are put on the table and people try to synchronize them. And so that is something we call upon in this paper that should be done, we believe, for the ocean, as it has been done on land and proven to be quite successful.
And right now, the world's largest banks and investment institutions are pouring trillions into offshore oil and gas and other projects. They loan big money to construct new fleets of fishing boats. Could finance be the bottleneck where we could exert some control about overuse of the sea's resources?
It certainly can be one of them. I don't know if it's the one, but finance has a role to play. And that's because of what you say. It's simply fueling that blue acceleration. To get those graphs going up and to get those trends like, you know, multiplying by like 30 folds over the last 20 years in some cases, then you need a lot of investment and you need a lot of capital. So the idea is, how can we use the financial sector to incentivize better practices and more sustainable practices? We're advocating in the paper is for a transformation of mainstream finance. Like the mainstream traditional financial mechanisms should take into consideration sustainability when it comes to ocean resources. But if we were to use that tool, which exists and which is used worldwide as the covenant, the agreement between the bank and the borrower, to incorporate sustainability criteria as part of the condition to obtain the credit, this would be really transformative because companies would have to comply with those conditions to obtain the money. And credit lending, like loans from banks, represents more than half of the external financing of corporation on average. So it's colossal, absolutely. That's one example. You can think of the same concept when it comes to stock exchanges, where companies go on if they want to be publicly listed, right, to gain exposure, brand exposure, to raise capital. Then I will go to a stock exchanges and get listed. To get listed on a stock exchange, you need to comply with the listing rules and requirements of this specific stock exchange. And again, this offers an opportunity for finance to play a key role in sustainability by incorporating sustainability requirements of better practices in order to become listed on your stock exchange. And this would be transformative.
The United Nations is about to declare a decade of ocean science for sustainable development. Now, personally, I wonder what ocean sustainable development would look like, and I think that we should probably just step back from using the ocean so much. But my real question here is, why doesn't the ocean have its own IPCC, its own institution to track the health of the high seas and make reports regularly like the paper you just published?
There are a lot of efforts across academic institutions and non-academic, like civil society groups and so on, that really focuses on the ocean. So, and the interest and the awareness, I believe, is growing. The move by the United Nations to declare that decade of ocean science, I think, goes in that same direction. It's to recognize the importance of the ocean for humanity, but also the timeliness of it in the sense that something is happening, and that's what we empirically show in our study, as a matter of fact, that it's not only starting now, but that it has started for the last 20 to 30 years. So it's really about time we do something about it. Now, all the groups working on climate is no different from the ocean in the sense that it's really interconnected. And the ocean is regulating the climate globally as well. So I think a lot of the work from the IPCC touches upon the ocean, and they released a report on ocean and poles a few months ago that was really trying to draw a state-of-the-art science for the ocean at the time.
But what about the rest of us? I mean, I feel like we all own a share of the sea. This shouldn't just be a discussion between big governments and multi-billionaire companies. What about the issue of fairness for all the people who are, say, in developing countries who really depend on the sea just to eat?
Yeah, and this is at the heart of ongoing negotiation. Again, the United Nations trying to to draw a treaty, a high sea treaty on benefit sharing and access when it comes particularly to access and benefit sharing of marine genetic resources in the areas beyond national jurisdiction, because they are not regulated right now. So anyone can go out there, scoop up something, register a patent on it, and there is no mechanism in place to ensure that, as you said, everyone, every citizen of the world actually would benefit from it. So this is the subject of ongoing negotiations that are expected to come to an end in 2020. For many reasons, 2020 is considered a super year of the ocean, given we are at the onset of the UN Decade of Ocean Science. There is the UN Ocean Conference taking place in Lisbon in June 2020, and there is this ongoing negotiation when it comes to biodiversity in the high seas. So it really is at the heart of it, the question of equity and who is benefiting, or rather not benefiting, from this blue acceleration. A lot of studies have pointed out that whether it's fishing or access to marine genetic resources or the offshore oil and gas industry, it's highly consolidated into the hands of a few corporations or a few economically powerful countries. And that raises a lot of question when it comes to smaller groups of more vulnerable local communities that highly depend on the ocean, including small island developing states, which some of them are becoming large ocean states given their access to the seafloor and to their exclusive economic zone. So all those are dynamics that are being discussed.
And finally, if all these trends of use and abuse of the ocean keep going straight up, as your study shows, what happens? Could we see a series of collapses like dying coral or the dying Baltic Sea?
Well, it's already happening. So in a way, we're already witnessing dying corals. We already have witnessed dying and very impacted Baltic Sea or the collapse of fish stock. So somehow we've been through that and we've got a taste of it. Where I'm more optimistic is because I would argue that the awareness for the environmental crisis and the awareness for the need of more sustainable trajectory has never been as high as of today. And that gives me hope, because I think there is a mobilization of citizens, of governments, even if it's a slower going, and of the private sector as well, to actually realize and recognize the emergency and the need to go on a more sustainable trajectory. So we've seen the collapse. It can get worse than what we've seen, but hopefully we'll act on time.
We've been speaking with Jean-Baptiste Jouffray, a bright young scientist working with the Global Economic Dynamics and Biosphere Program at the Royal Swedish Academy and the Stockholm Resilience Center. Please pass this program on to your friends. Get it free at ecoshock.org. And join me again next week.